Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, exploring the cultures of consciousness. I've been doing this so long now, it seems to me that I feel like I should be saying exploring the cultures of consciousness since 2010, which is when the podcast started. But actually, I've been having these conversations throughout my life. I mean, temperamentally, I'm kind of more of a humanities, poetry, religion, social science, history kind of guy. But I've always been interested in science, and indeed thought at one point that I would study science and particularly mathematics and music. And I probably got this because I started having these conversations with my dad, who's an engineer and a very well-respected scientist and oceanographer who works on physics and works on semi-automated robot underwater devices, which we'll be talking more about this show. He's actually being feted here in San Francisco next week at the Geophysical Society meeting, so that'll be kind of fun to get a slice of the science. And so my conversations and interest in engineering and robots and the future of computer technology really began talking with him and visiting his lab when I was a kid. And then another major influence on me that, you know, set in motion ideas and interests that later manifested as technosis was my friendship and conversations with our guest today, David Mindell. And David teaches history and engineering at MIT, and he's also an engineer and a roboticist himself with a fistful of patents, and has really done a really unusual and remarkable job of working between humanity's concerns with history and thinking about larger social forces, psychological forces, but also in the context of engineering and the history of technology. But then he's also an engineer, so he really knows it from the inside and has worked on many of the kinds of devices and situations that he's also written about in really great books like Digital Apollo and Between Human and Machine. And Dave and I started having conversations. We met as undergraduates at Yale, and I was, you know, instantly taken again with that wonderful mixture of humanities and engineering. I learned a lot from him. I learned a lot about cybernetics, got sort of interested in a lot of those issues about engineering and consciousness and human agency. And so I was very happy to hook up with him again at our 25th reunion, unfortunately, for the ticking clock of mortality on the wall, but fortunate for the fun that it provides to meet up with old pals. And Dave told me about his new book, which is called Are Robots Ourselves? Robots and the Myths of Autonomy. And this is his first sort of more pop book. His other books are very readable, but they are academic, scholarly histories, really tracing the history of the interactions and interface between human beings and technological systems in a very, very fine-grained, nitty-gritty way that really does a wonderful job, especially in his new book, of balancing out the, you know, frequently really terrible representations of these kinds of problems and issues inside of the mainstream media and even inside of pop technology discourse, where it's so easy to get caught up in various kind of science fiction infused ideas and models about robotics, about the future of autonomy in machines, and indeed artificial intelligence, and all these things get all kind of mixed up and mushed together. And Our Robots Ourselves does a really wonderful, again, fine-grained but very readable examination of how human technology, human-machine interfaces work in extreme environments. So the idea is that to understand the future of our interactions with semi-robotic devices, let's say the automated cars of the future, in whatever form they will take, or semi-automated cars, that one way to understand what lies ahead for us in our normal lives is to look at how humans have been using and interacting with machines in extreme environments. So these are deep underwater environments, deep sea environments, space, warfare, and by looking and aeronautics. And so he looks at all of these places, and really just, it's really mind-blowing to realize, you know, as some, you know, I always read about, you know, air crashes and problems with automation and, you know, the future of aviation, you know, that get very interested in that, like a lot of people. It's, and then reading through through his chapter on it, just mind-blowing how many assumptions I had had that were wrong about the ways in which pilots interact with machines and the complexities of determining where control is, when control is handed off. So I really highly recommend this book for people who are interested in these topics, because it really cleaned up my lenses, and I think will clean up, I hope will clean up a lot of other lenses and see the kind of richer complexity of the problem. Anyway, enough of that. Dave, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
My pleasure. As you said, it's part of a 30-year conversation.
Yeah, no, it's really a treat. I've really enjoyed your career, and I've really learned a lot from your books and this one too. But I want you to talk a little bit about your own engineering. The first chapter in the book is about you and Bob Ballard and some of the undersea technology developments that you were involved in. So that might be a fun place to start. Talk a little bit about how this machine-human interface problem is something that you have worked out, you know, firsthand with your involvement with some of these projects.
Sure. Well, within a year of when you and I were sitting around talking and writing about Philip K. Dick and Thomas Pynchon, I found myself going to see building and operating robots in the very deep ocean, you know, miles and miles down. I joined Bob Ballard's group, you know, a couple of years after they found the Titanic, and we proceeded to travel around, you know, looking at stuff on the deep ocean, shipwrecks and hydrothermal vents primarily. And at the time, the kind of established technology was a submersible called Alvin, pretty well known in the kind of public science world. And Alvin, at that time already, had been taking three people to the seafloor for 25 years. And there was a lot of resistance on the part of scientists saying, you know, what are you guys doing with these robots? You can't do oceanography with a robot. If you don't really go down and visit the seafloor with your body, you're not really doing the science. And we thought, oh, well, look at our robots. They're going to be cheaper and they're going to be safer. And it turned out that they weren't cheaper and they weren't safer. But it did turn out that they reconfigured the entire kind of sense of doing the work on the seafloor, not least because they just, instead of three people in the sphere talking to each other, one of whom was a pilot, suddenly you had 30 people on the surface of the ship connected to the seafloor through a remote cable. And at the time, it was just kind of crappy old color TV style stuff, but the images were pretty stunning still. And being in a darkened trailer with 30 people and five TV monitors connected to a robot that was 3, 4, 5 miles below really transported you into that kind of dark environment and changed the nature of the way the science got done, changed the nature of the way the engineering got done, and created a whole new sense of presence. At the same time, we were convinced that that sense of remote presence was going to be replaced by autonomous vehicles and vehicles that went down and really did do the work on their own. And none of those things happened. Today we live in a world where Woods Hole just spent a good chunk of their endowment to build a new Alvin, which has code in it that was written for autonomous vehicles. The remote vehicles are still around. In fact, the lines between what it means to be humanly directly present and remotely present and to be present through autonomy, if anything, those lines are just blurring. And you have a world where we kind of coexist and move back and forth in real time between human, remote, and autonomous.
Yeah, let me pull out a couple of things from that I really learned or was more exposed to reading your nitty-gritty accounts. One is the way that these devices, even if they're partly operating autonomously for part of the time, that when you shift away from the physical body, you know, directly using, you know, being submersed to this 30 guys in a dark room with monitors, you extend the kind of network of conversations that infuse the situation, and particularly in your account of killing drones, predator, and whether we call them drones or not, that's another conversation to have. But when you were describing that, you know, there's a kind of image in the popular mind. Well, you got these pilots who are sitting in some trailer in Nevada, and they're, you know, and then you get this idea of like two guys sitting there going out there and doing all this stuff. But of course, it's not two guys. It's two guys who are also hooked up with all of these, you know, online chat networks, and there's all of this live intelligence of other human beings that are part of the decision making apparatus. And it really shifts the mind, because it feels like we have a kind of, it's an understandable tendency, but we have a tendency to kind of simplify the idea of what human agency already is in these kinds of environments. Oh, it's just there's either a guy there who's piloting it, like the pilot is piloting the plane, or he's not. And it's just a completely automated, it's on its own, it's a robot, it's an artificial intelligence. And that zone in between is where all the action is. And it's really hard to think about. I mean, what are some of the challenges and some of the things, ways that you have learned to think about what happens when you have these more enmeshed, complicated, interactive environments?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one way is just time and space. Okay, so remote presence is a way of shifting human agency in space. And autonomy, in many ways, is a way of shifting human presence in time. So, you know, every autonomous robot is still programmed, and it still brings data back to people, and that just pushes the human presence to, you know, ahead of the actual expedition or after it. And if you ask the questions, not are there people or are there no people, or is it automated or is it manual, those are the questions I'm trying to move beyond. I'm just trying to ask the questions, where are the people, which people are they, what are they doing, and when are they doing it? And if you ask those questions, you're always able to trace through the network and find where the people are. And the shifts, those shifts all matter. It's not that they're trivial and they're by no means equivalent cognitively or socially or many other ways. But there's still people around somewhere, and you're always able to ferret them out. There's always a wrapper of human behavior somewhere. And what you think of as an autonomous robot is almost always a robot that's going forth away from a set of human handlers and coming back to those human handlers. Almost by definition, that's what makes it useful. And so that's, in a way, a very simple way to think about that. If you look at the Predator story that you mentioned, you know, people always think about these remote split operations where they bring them back, the operators, to the desert in Las Vegas or other places in the U.S. to operate halfway around the world, because somehow the operators are safer there. You know, safety was not what motivated that shift. The reason they took the operators out of Afghanistan and Iraq and put them initially into Creech Air Force Base in Las Vegas is because within the field operating units, they don't have access to the classified networks that you have when you're on an American base on American soil. And so by bringing the operators back into the continental U.S., they bring them into a much, much richer information and communications landscape than they could be when they're actually out in the theater of war. And that was the key thing that brought them back, and that's the key thing they take advantage of. Now, that has all kinds of complications, like, you know, they say the Predator pilot is never alone. They have a much larger set of constituents that they have to satisfy and deal with and interact with than, you know, a small unit operating out in a field. Very analogous to what we experienced in the undersea world about 15 years before that as well. So the shifts are important, and the social shifts really matter. And ultimately, the Predator operators are staring at buildings and other things halfway around the world through grainy kind of black and white infrared video. But it's that set of social relationships, both on their side within the network and with the people they're watching, whether friendly or foe, that gives them a sense of presence in the place they're looking.
One of the things I was interested in the Predator chapter, which again was like my, you know, the gulf between reading a fine-grained just on the ground accounts of how these systems work, in contrast to the kinds of ways that the Predator's taken off as a symbol and a an image of, you know, corrupt American power, or the evil Skynet Terminator world of the future, or all of these ways that it has become like the symbol, like all, like also even commercial drones, and even the term drone is kind of a problem. But what one of the things that I also learned from your account that was fascinating is how the status of the pilots has also been really a big deal within the military, like in terms of whether these people, how are they recognized? What's level of the hierarchy are there? Because the military is very hierarchical in terms of status, in terms of reputation and respect, and even whether these guys can get, what kind of medals they can get. And that was a very interesting story too, because the military has its own reasons for holding on to the old world of the man in control. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, that's a great example of, like, the shifts matter, right? Where your body is matters. Even if you could say, and usually can't say this anyway, even if you could say that cognitively the experience is the same when you take the body out of the physical presence, the social experience and the cultural weight of the activity is changed by where the body is. And the military and war is a place I've always found interesting to study for this, because the risks are so obvious, and the kind of social function of the kind of military structure around keeping order around state-structured violence is so old and so traditional, and you know, for some good reasons there, I think. And the degree to which systems like Predator have really upended the social order within the Air Force particularly is not to be overestimated. Interestingly, the Army operates a very similar aircraft. It's slightly more automated, and they have all enlisted operators flying it, whereas the Air Force still uses what they call rated pilots, or highly educated officers in the left seat, in the commander's seat of the Predator. They can't quite bring themselves to have enlisted people, quote-unquote, flying, even though mostly they're monitoring the series of autopilots that make the thing go.
It's so incredible. You know, and just because we're on the topic, and, you know, a lot of people are, there is something very powerful about the Predator symbolically, what it ends up indicating in ways that maybe aren't appropriate for the particular technology, and in some ways are appropriate for a kind of vision of a sort of remotely controlled future battlefield that's everywhere, you know, not even just in traditional war theaters, but, you know, domestically, et cetera, et cetera. So there is some kind of legitimate science fiction concern there, but at the same time, there are also, I think, errors in how people see and understand the Predator that really get in the way of kind of understanding, in some ways, the deeper problems. What would you say that would be the thing to kind of most clarify, if you could clarify that large public conversation a little bit, what would be the thing that you would try to bring forward?
Well, again, you know, I say this in the book, like, I'm not really taking on the question of intelligence in the book for a variety of reasons. And I don't really make any claims about whether the systems I'm writing about or I've worked with are intelligent or not intelligent, not least because there's so many different and very rich notions of cognition out there these days. But what I do argue is that they're not inhuman, right? And that there's this huge just substrate of human judgment and intention in almost especially in the most highly computerized automated type systems. You know, I go through some of the DARPA Grand Challenge vehicles that were the predecessors to the Google car. You know, those vehicles, which operated autonomously, they had 1,300 lines of code just to set the configuration parameters. And every one of those lines was just a number that someone took a guess at that said, you know, when a car is closer than this many meters, that's when you consider it too close. And there are hundreds and hundreds of those kind of human set parameters. And people are constantly encoding these kind of judgments in these systems. Any autonomous navigation algorithm is going to work by optimizing cost functions, okay? And I work in a building full of people who study how to optimize those cost functions. But how you set those cost functions is a, you know, this huge amount of judgment. Does your automated car optimize for performance, or does it optimize for safety? And if it optimizes for safety, does it optimize for your safety or other people's safety? Does it optimize for environmental impact or speed, right? And there's somebody out there setting those parameters for you. I partly argue in the book, you ought to imagine a world where you can set those parameters, because those are important things that humans ought to have input in.
Yeah, your example there is, you know, when you have, you know, let's say you're driving a semi-automatic car, and one day it's just you alone, and you're pretty confident in your driving skills and ability to take over, and you're driving alone, and you got to get somewhere fast. You might want to, you know, have a little bit more risk in the picture. The next day, you have your two kids in the back seat, and you're not late. You're gonna, you know, you're gonna maximize safety. I mean, but I think one of the issues here is this tendency, which is partly fomented by technology and computer firms, and partly an effect of science fiction and just how human beings think, is that people who don't actually deal with engineering, or even people who do certain kinds of work with computers but not necessarily out in the world, there's a tendency to kind of, it's like the computer's doing something, and you forget that it's a programmable device, and the programming are human decisions that are made somewhere upstream. And a really good example of this, the way you encounter these parameters and you realize that there's a human there, or a groups of humans, is for me when I get in a car that has one of those the beeps when you're backing up. And you know, I live in a city, I'm a good driver, I'm a good parallel parker, I know how to parallel park, and I know when it hits the beep where it's like beep, like stop now, you're about to hit the car, that actually you have a little bit more play. And at that moment, I always imagine some guy kind of like, well, let's hedge this one a little bit, because we really don't want, you know. And I'm like, I'm sorry, guy, I'm not going to trust you. I have to like go beyond that in that moment. But I feel the presence, not of the car telling me something or a beep telling me something. I actually get a sense of like some programmer or manager more likely going, okay, no, that's the point. And I'm like, I'm sorry, guys, I'm not going to do that.
Well, right, and that, not just manager, but also lawyer, right?
Yeah.
And so the company's interests in when that beep goes on are not the same as your interests, right? They're actively trying to shift liability in certain ways. You know, this is true in aircraft. It's very stark in aircraft. Like the user manual for an airplane is not designed as a window into that system, right? The user manual on airplane and the pilot's operating handbook is designed to limit and obscure the workings of the system to a very small number of rules that the company can stand behind in a legal sense. That's all it is. There is no document that really tells you how the airplane really works. That's up to the pilot to figure out through experience.
That's amazing. Oh, my God. When you get into the legal side of all this stuff, it gets so complicated. And you as you said, you bring up some of those issues in regards to the future of the automated car. You did in some ways you could say, you know, at the most of the book, you're have a kind of anthropological, scholarly distance. You're not making super heavy claims one way or the other. You're just trying to explain all the complexities of these things that we already see, that are already operative in our world. And towards the end, you bring in a little bit more of a kind of critical analysis, and you particularly talk about the sort of model or hype that we hear from Google about the future of the automated car. And it's a really, really eye-opening discussion, because it made me realize, A, there are so many different models of the kinds of interactivity that could be happening in the future between ourselves and our cars, and that what we hear from Google is really a particular philosophy that is very strong and very on one side of the discussion. And that there are, you know, in some ways your book is a great argument for what's wrong with that model, and how there's other ways of thinking about it that could in many ways for many reasons be better. So I'd just love to hear you talk a little bit about Google's model, how they came to it, or you know what their approach is, and maybe why a little bit, but then also what are some problems with it.
Yeah, I mean, Google's model is that people are idiots, that there's no way to design an autonomous system without the operator becoming complacent and losing attention. And therefore, if the human ever needs to re-involve themselves in the system, they're going to be sleeping or unable to do so. And therefore, you should have a fully autonomous system from the get-go that has no possibility for human input at all, and the human should be able to go to sleep in the trunk while their kids are strapped into the back seat. And, I mean, the book is full of examples from as far back as the 60s, but as far recently as the last few years, of systems that started out with that kind of utopian full autonomy vision, and just the rough and tumble reality of getting any system that has the capacity to hurt and kill people, which cars certainly do, out into the field, come up against the messy realities of how stuff works with mud on it when people are tired and when the door doesn't work and so on, that human interventions, just as an empirical fact, have always been put in for these kind of life-critical systems. And if you think about it at a more philosophical scale, though, the claim from Google is that they will have figured out every possible thing that could ever possibly happen, every possible situation that could ever possibly happen in a car. If any car anywhere has ever seen it, it shares it with all the other Google cars in the world. And there is never any possibility for the person whose rear end is on the line and the person who is situationally in the environment in the moment will literally never have anything to add, okay? And I just don't believe that is true, right? You can argue whether the person should be involved 99% of the time or 1% of the time. There's all kinds of good arguments to be had in different parts of that. But the argument that the person should be involved zero is just never been proven to be the right way to go. There's absolutely no empirical evidence that it improves performance or saves lives or increases safety or anything. Maybe someday they'll come up with some evidence for that, but at the moment there's none. It's purely based on faith and a kind of idea that progress somehow is progress toward fully unmanned. And again, we know that there's no such thing as fully unmanned. We know that somebody's got to be turning that risk knob that you mentioned up or down or other types of knobs. I argue actually in the book that we really ought to rethink progress, that the highest level of progress is the sort of perfectly integrated human with autonomy, where you have the automated decision making when you need it, and you can drive with your hands when you need it, and you have this kind of, you know, ideal trade-off. Maybe that ideal is unattainable as well, but it's a much more likely thing to come out. And by the way, it's compatible with the systems that we have, as opposed to a system where you have only fully autonomous cars out on the road, which is never going to happen.
Well, you mentioned it just now, this concept of progress, and I thought that was a really very key argument in the book, because today things are so confusing and things are so apocalyptic in so many ways that, like, in most regards, I think your average person no longer believes the myth of progress that drove the 20th century, that, you know, you're going to, and even earlier, you know, we're going to get smarter and better at using reason in order to design systems and machines that are going to produce more and more utopian kinds of effects. And we can imagine a future of leisure, and all these kind of promises. And you can look at the 20th century as a series of promises about how, you know, the sci-fi future is going to work. And I think in many regards, people no longer quite believe it in a lot of ways, but then in other ways, we still do. We still really want that to be true. You know, I think we want it to be true about our digital devices. We really think the next upgrade is going to, like, deliver some kind of magic that the one we're using now isn't, as opposed to recognizing that everything is always kind of screwed up and there's some kind of fault in it and there's actually downsides to, you know, deeper integration, et cetera, et cetera. But this is another example that in our, I think, science fiction infused tendency to imagine the autonomous robot, and so that anytime that our devices begin to become more automated, to become more quote unquote intelligent, that, like, okay, this is just the beginning of this line of evolutionary necessity that's going to wind up at pure autonomy, that's also just kind of a myth that we're carrying around.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in general, progress is what we make of it, right? And I've worked a lot on the period of the 1960s, and, you know, the idea, one of the reasons I wrote a book about the Apollo program is that it was the end of the 20th century notion of progress, that faster, higher, further was the way you're going to go. And if you told someone in the 60s, and many of those people are still alive, that we would measure progress by the number of transistors on a chip the size of your thumbnail, they'd laugh at you, right? They find that completely uninspiring and unimportant. And as a historian of technology, which is sort of my other day job, I also know that what we imagine as progress in technology is something that people have imagined and people have sold for one reason or another. So I'm just saying, you know, people have bought into this notion of kind of moving toward full autonomy for a variety of reasons from the 20th century. It happens to be antiquated, and it's much more interesting and I think kind of socially, ethically valuable, but I also think economically valuable to think about a world where we share our autonomy with machines in a kind of beautiful, fluid, collaborative way.
Cool. Well, we're going to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. We're talking with David Mendel about his book, Our Robots, Ourselves. And we'll be right back after a couple of messages.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to invite you to listen to Warrior Connection on the Progressive Radio Network. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we're doing the best we can for the veterans of our nation. Warrior Connection is an ongoing discussion with veterans, scientists, politicians, journalists, reporters, and doctors about the health and environmental effects of war on our nation's veterans. Our purpose is to provide the information necessary for all veterans to lead a productive life. Thank you very much, and God bless America.
This is Guy McPherson. Join me and Mike Sliva with Nature Bat's Last Radio on PRN.FM. Catch us Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. on the East Coast. You can rate the show on iTunes, and if you don't catch us live, you can catch us 24/7 in the PRN archives. That's 8 p.m. Eastern Time with Nature Bat's Last on PRN.FM.
PRN would like to thank its listeners for making us number one on Zeno Radio's phone service and also the top searched internet radio station on Google. Thank you for helping us move forward.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. Eric Davis talking with David Mendel about robotics and the myths of autonomy. I mentioned earlier the problem with the word, or the potential problem with the word drone. And it's a very interesting one because I think reflecting on both the term, why it came about, what the problems with it are, what other terms might be, but also just the larger question of how, as these new technologies that are, you know, quite transformative in their social, economic, political implications, as they enter into society at large, you know, they go through the system where they're represented by, you know, publicity agencies, journalists, popular fictions. It's this very weird world where we develop our language about these things, and all that language has certain implications, some of which are kind of hidden from us. And the drone is a really good example of that process happening. And, as you talk about in the book, and I'm sure you've noticed in other contexts as well. So I'd just like to hear a little bit about, like, you know, when did we first start using that term? Why? What's disguised behind it? What we might replace it with? Is it possible? Is it too late?
So, yeah, I mean, the word was introduced in the 30s by an American Army officer to describe an American system, a kind of proto, you know, autonomous air vehicle, to contrast it with a British system called Queen Bee. So he was clearly like sort of a diminutive reference to his own system as something that was not quite as grand as the Queen Bee and a kind of, you know, a low-level worker. And the word had a long history in, and this is the place that, you know, autonomous unmanned vehicles in aerial warfare have been around for decades and decades, particularly as targets. You know, they use them as sort of practice targets, to practice target shooting rather than to shoot at either a live aircraft or a towed banner or something. So it has a connotation of, you know, what in the 18th century would be called an automaton, something that goes through a kind of low-level clockwork precision with unthinking, you know, mechanical repetition. And I think probably most people's current cultural connotation of the word comes from, you know, some of the Star Wars movies, where the drones are exactly that kind of warrior robots with unthinking. And I'm not that much of a Star Wars scholar to be able to intone on the details of those characters. And at some level, and, you know, I think we do have to live with the word. It's a word that means something to people. Language sticks for a reason. You can't just say people are using the wrong notion. I think the larger issue, which I've been struggling with, and is one that writing the book really brought to, is, you know, there is a rich cultural tradition of artificial life, from Pygmalion and Galatea to, you know, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and many centuries old, and it's valuable, and you can't just write that off and say that doesn't reflect the reality of how people use machines on the ground. There's a real kind of, you know, human mechanical philosophical set of questions that are getting worked out there. And I have respect for my colleagues who are spending their time in some way trying to build artificial humans. That's a kind of, to me, that's engineering at its philosophical best. And all I really argue for in the book is, don't confuse people doing philosophy with the way people operate systems on the ground. And they're not the same thing. And when they get operated in real environments, they become a different thing, and they're a little bit less romantic and maybe less scary. Although, as I've said elsewhere, you're more likely to be killed by a poorly designed robot than by an evil robot. and it's very likely that you can get killed by a poorly designed robot. That's a genuinely scary thing. And I don't know that anybody's been killed by an evil robot yet. And yeah, so, you know, how you kind of reconcile, you know, if you look at the history of pilots in the early 20th century, at the early aviation, there's a great historian, Robert Wohl, wrote that the early history of piloting aircraft is fundamentally about the contrast between the public mythologies used to describe the Birdman and the actual skills required to fly it. And I think that's something we're really stuck with in this moment, is the public mythologies, which are, in my universe, these are real things. They're not just sort of bad PR or lies that people spread or anything like that. There's a real cultural weight to them that you have to take seriously. But there's a dissonance between that weight and the way these things play out on the ground. And I think that's part of the story that I want to tell, is like, whatever you want to say about Predator and whatever one thinks about how it shaped out, what it certainly is surprising. It is not the story that even the people who built that system expected it to play out as. And you got to be prepared for those surprises. And even as an engineer, you want to design to let your users figure out what things are good for and be prepared to be surprised. And again, away from the notion of full autonomy, where they figured it all out before you even get in the thing and there's nothing new to add.
Right. Well, so what were some of the big surprises with the Predator?
Well, it was designed to be a kind of remote aerial photography platform. And what the surprise was that the video that it brought back, which was not something, you know, traditional kind of military photo reconnaissance people, they like big 8x10 glossies, right? And there are stories of them taking the video from Predator and printing it out in 8x10 glossies. One of the big surprises was that the policymakers, the generals, right up into the top of the White House, became addicted, what they called Predator porn. The video of the live battlefield was incredibly compelling. And nobody had really thought that through very well before. Another one of the surprises was, as I mentioned earlier, the connections to the network were the things that the operators needed. And that it was their interaction with all these different elements all over the country, all over the world, that created the task, not the kind of lone autonomous vehicle. Predator was designed with almost no ground control station when it was built. It was designed to be unmanned. Why would you need a ground control station? And instead, you end up a ground control station that has 16 different displays and 6 different keyboards and 4 trackballs and very, very rich, complicated user interface.
You know, I'm thinking about the you mentioned Star Wars, and I was going to ask you a question about it because I recently rewatched the original trilogy, the 4, 5, 6, and I was paying, you know, since I'd seen it so many times, I was kind of looking at all these odd things, like I was looking at all the objects and how they were designed and the you know, the fonts on the screens and, you know, all this kind of like weird little details, and I hadn't really thought about the way in which you know, on the one hand, Luke's destruction of the Death Star is a sign of the old school, you know, the romantic mode, the one where the you know, you turn off the automated systems and you fly by the seat of your pants and you make the move out of your kind of intuitive emergent skill of the you know, the hitting the, you know, the arrowhead with your eyes closed, or the, you know, the bullseye with your eyes closed kind of thing. But I was also really interested in, that I had never kind of noticed before, how all the X-Wing fighters have their own, you know, R2-D2 unit. Mm-hmm. And the way in which there was already an idea of that it wasn't just that the plane would have all these sophisticated systems, but that in some sense a kind of other mind or an other intelligent thinking thing was necessary, that you also needed to bring this character in to the X-Wing fighter along with the human being. And it just sort of struck me as a more complicated symbol in a way than I had thought about initially. And you talk about Star Wars a couple times in the book, and I'm also not a scholar, and I probably have already made mistakes, but it is interesting, you know, looking ahead to the new film and the way in which part of the hype and part of what makes it attractive, I bought my tickets too in advance, like everybody, was, you know, that the absence of CGI, you know, it was like, okay, so there's some way in which, like, Star Wars already is this weird myth object that we think through these technological relations with. I'm curious whether what your feeling is, or looking at popular culture, looking at representations of robots, dystopian, utopian, whatever. Do you have a sense of things changing, of like new myths emerging that in some ways are more appropriate for the, in many ways, actual world we're going to face, where everything is always complex, we're always enmeshed in these networks, full knowledge is never available, it's always kind of confusing, things are never quite working correctly, and that's really the kind of actual state of things, and will be so in more ways than we even have now, I believe. Do you see kind of myths changing, or do you think that myth of that the seat of the pants pilot is just going to hold on regardless of the facts on the ground?
Well, I think, I mean, there's a lot to say there. I think one of the interesting things about that Star Wars relationship is it's ultimately a social relationship with the machine, right? And that he brings the little R2 unit onto the plane because he already has a social interaction. There's context to that relationship, and somehow the R2 unit better understands Luke and his desires than the kind of dumb X-Wing, which has been pre-programmed to do whatever it does. And you know, and DARPA and others in the DOD have been trying to do that for years. There was a famous project in the 80s called the Pilots Associate, which was designed to do that. And I mentioned this in the book. I've been working a little bit on a project that also is a DARPA project that aims to do that kind of thing. I do think that understanding how people can relate socially to robots. Not sociably, like there's a sort of sociable robot movement that puts like nice, you know, blinky eyes and smiley faces on robots. This is a different thing, but really understand how the relationships can work between people and complex systems. At the same time, I mean, I guess the myths probably will change. Certainly, mythologies of the computers changed as people got their hands on them and realized that, you know, they didn't do the, you know, you always think about that great, I think it was Star Trek III, where Scotty comes down to Earth and he picks up the mouse and he talks into it and says, "Computer." Of course, it doesn't do anything. It's like a Mac 2 or something. That people's mythologies and surrounding computers do change as they have personal experience with them. And most people don't have personal experience with various kinds of robotic systems. And so as they get them, you know, maybe they will have a change on in that world. You know, we'll see.
But people do have, I mean, I was thinking again of ways that people could learn to kind of rethink their existing lives and their relationships with technologies and machines, computers and other things in their existing lives, where that sense of a social relation is not a sociable relation, not the one where with the happy, fluffy, you know, robotic toy or the user interface that's all blinky and designed for human desires or whatever, but all of the machines and even tools that we work with, what it means to have relations with them seems to me to be a good thing to cultivate in awareness rather than just sort of being automatic about it. Because the thing about tools is like, you know, like Heidegger has that argument about like, well, you know, when you're using a tool and the tool is working, the tool disappears. And the tool only really like re-enters your consciousness when it breaks. And then you're like, ah, this hammer, it's like the head's coming off. I can't use it. Oh, geez. And up to that point, it's just like a thing that you extend. But the technologies that we're dealing with now are so complicated, and that in some ways they're already, you know, they have their own agency or their own thing to say, or sets of things to say in any given situation. And I think that a lot of us operate kind of with that half consciously and half unconsciously, because we're kind of moving through these different paradigms of the tool that you just assimilate as an extension of your will to something that kind of has its own thing to say, or is sort of recalcitrant or difficult to operate with. And it feels like part of what we're shifting towards, and that we should be in some ways consciously shifting towards, at least in terms of the vision of the future that you put forward in the book, is one where we just accept that there are better and worse ways to be kind of in constant on and off dialogue with different systems as we move through our day. Even that might sound kind of claustrophobic in some ways, kind of overly complex in other ways. You know, it's going to be kind of hair-raising in some sense. That feels like the most humanist way to kind of approach the relations that we already have with things.
Yeah, I think that's right on. I think you, first of all, when you have relationships with things, those relationships are never simple, and they always bring a whole set of baggage to them, usually the baggage of other people, right? So you think you're just logging on to Google search some interesting factoid, when actually you're, you know, contributing to the world's largest database of human intention that's being used for other things. And there are interests there. There are other people who are there. And those very simple tasks are embedded in these very deep relations. I quote in the book a DoD report that came out in 2012 that said, there are no fully autonomous robots, just there's no fully autonomous sailors, marines, soldiers, or airmen. And you can extend that to almost any human relationship, right? We're always embedded. We always think we're autonomous, but we're actually always living in relation to any number of different sets of relationships. I also quote a friend of mine, late friend of mine, Seth Teller, who was a roboticist at MIT, who said, you know, driving a car is hundreds of short-lived social contracts. And in some way, that's a pretty good metaphor for a lot of other of these kinds of tasks like you're talking about, where you're always existing in very short-term but very highly structured and ideally fairly well understood and precise relationships to different objects, different people, different systems. We've been living like that as people for a very long time. We've been living like that related to objects for a very long time. but now we're in a position to engineer the relationships in very different ways than when we've been before.
Yeah, yeah. I was really struck by that passage. He sounded like he was a cool dude, because I just immediately flashed on like my last, you know, couple experiences driving. And again, it's like it's we're both aware of it and not aware of it. Like obviously, when I'm driving, I stop, I look. Oh, there's a pedestrian. I look in their eyes to let them know that I've seen them, so they can be calm and they do that. And then I go out and I'm looking at the car across the street. Are they going to make a left? Are they going straight? Do they see me? And I was like, suddenly, like, wow, there's all of these little handoffs that we're doing, and also with the vehicle or whatever, seeing what's going on or putting on the cruise drive or whatever. There's all of these kind of relations going on, and again, we don't quite see it. Like we don't quite recognize it. Maybe because it's, in some ways it's easier to do when you're only half paying attention to all of these relations rather than thinking, oh, now I'm moving from this relationship to this relationship or this situation to this situation. But it seems like a helpful. I know that in my life I've been trying to cultivate this sense, and also not just with machines or human artifacts, but also of course with the environment and the biosphere, which are a whole other set of relations that right. we're completely embedded in, that all of these flows and fluids, and that's important to reflect on as a set of relationships. So anyway, just that's a trivia thing, and we only have a few minutes left here. One question I really have for you: you are an engineer, you're trained as an engineer, you're also a historian, and cultural critic in some ways. But you've been around a lot of engineers, and when you talked about Google earlier, you know, about the problems with the fully autonomous model, the human beings are idiots model. And you describe the way, you know, one of the problems with that model is that it doesn't really take into account social, psychological, political, and to some degree even economic situations, but certainly the social side of things. And when I think about that, I go, well, part of that is seems like a kind of, you know, engineering idealism, that there's a kind of psychological set among many, not all, but many engineers and engineering firms, engineering design philosophies, that is sort of somewhat detached from what I see and what you see as a messier world, where all of these different social, psychological, historical, embodied forces constrain the kind of exuberance and technical acuity of engineering systems. But right now we're in a world where a lot of engineers and engineering philosophy informed philosophies about the future, about human beings, have that like engineering tang to them. And I can say that very personally, living here in the Bay Area and being interested in this stuff, but also not really of it, and interfacing with it on all sorts of different levels. Can you reflect a little bit on this sort of that kind of engineering mindset? What's happening to it? Does it worry you to some degree? Is it changing? I think you understand what I'm asking.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you're right. I use the word utopian autonomy very deliberately in the book. There is a kind of engineering utopianism to like the clean, you know, driverless cars all moving around, right? Uniformly, when you see those environments represented, they're clean of people, right? The future in a certain way is always a kind of either clean or very homogeneous socially world. I mean, I have friends that in my department at MIT who say, hey, we're engineers, you know, we don't like to think about people. We don't know how to do that. And that's a pretty fair assessment. The argument about driverless cars is driving, you know, exclusively a task about path planning and collision avoidance, or is driving a social task that has other dimensions that you need to consider? And I think you can consider those dimensions without, you know, a whole lot of nostalgia for, a kind of essential humanist anything about what it means to operate a car. The interesting thing about the response to my book is that sometimes I get people who say, oh, well, you're just talking about the past. You don't know about the future. The future is all pure autonomy and it's all going to be perfectly safe, right? And I say, you know, I'm open to being wrong. But my book is based on a mountain of empirical evidence about how these systems work in the real world. Your belief in the future and the future of full autonomy is about faith and ideology, right? And you're coming at an engineering argument from a position of faith and ideology. I'm coming at it from a position of evidence. I'm happy to admit that I might be wrong, but I'm not going to, you know, let go of that argument based on faith and ideology.
Yeah, that's very well said. You know, it's interesting. That was one of the elements of the threads of technosis, is to look at the engineering, the utopianism of engineering, and that, how deep and profoundly it's woven into the Enlightenment and the history of the West and the Royal Society and the history of science. And it's really, you know, it's a very, very powerful, you know, deeply embedded ideology that also has been very successful at producing a lot of things. But that success has required a lot of strategies of disavowal and kind of what psychologists would call splitting, so that you can maintain the kind of utopian drive, even as the evidence, the historical evidence for the complexities, mounts and mounts into the sort of wreckage of actual civilization.
I'd say also it's successful when machines are successful when they're able to shed some of the utopianism in favor of a kind of gritty adaptability. And when they can let go of some of the kind of early rigid design planning and really adapt and let their users adapt them into real situations, that's when engineering is most successful.
That's great. Well, we think we're going to have to wrap it up there. Hey, Dave, thanks so much for joining us and expanding mine. It was a great conversation.
Sure. 30 more years of it, huh?
Yeah, that's good. We've got to keep it going. I look forward to the next thing. So, folks, once again, Are Robots Ourselves, Robotics in the Midst of Autonomy. It's really a fascinating book, and it really cleanses the doors of perception. So check it out. And who are we talking to next week? What are we doing? I can't remember. Anyway, you're going to have to tune in and find out. All right, from me here at Expanding Mind, all you out there, keep your minds open.